This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers, sponsors of Great Conversation.
Welcome to the View from 22 podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, The Spectator's assistant editor. In this week's issue, we'll be discussing Barack Obama's intervention in the Brexit debate, David Cameron's Pyrrhic victory over Europe, and on the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, asking just how did the bard kick the bucket? On to our first topic. 12 years ago, Barack Obama captured the American imagination with a speech in which he pledged to unite a divided country.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
In his cover story this week, Tim Montgomery says that Obama has done the exact opposite, and that his divisive behaviour has led directly to the fist-shaking of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Now the president is coming to Britain, apparently to give his blessing to the EU Remain campaign. But will it work? I'm joined now by my colleague Freddie Gray and The Telegraph's Janet Daly to discuss. Janet Daly, why shouldn't the US president have a view on the European referendum?
Oh, he's perfectly entitled to have a view and he should express it at home. I don't know what possessed Cameron, I assume it was Cameron, to think this was a clever idea, but it's going to be almost entirely counterproductive. The British don't like being lectured by foreign leaders anyway about how they should vote. And given that Obama's weakest point over the two administrations has been his foreign policy, I'd have thought this would be the last thing in the world that he would want to be making a recommendation on for any other country.
Freddie Gray, isn't it the case that Obama's much more popular over here than he is in America? So he might as well come over here where he's got a little bit of rock star appeal still.
There's a little bit of truth in that. But I think the really sad thing about this week is that, you know, Cameron and Osborne still buy into this Obama brand of 2008 that just isn't real anymore. And I mean, it's certainly true that he still has sort of element of cool among the sort of liberal left here. But polls of Brits done this week suggest that they're not that bothered what he thinks about the EU. It's sort of pathetic that Cameron and Osborne have to sort of bring him in as their sort of rock star when actually everyone just finds him a bit of a has-been. Yeah, it's a bit of a has-been, yeah.
His high point was that moment when he was running for president and he went to Berlin and he was received like the second coming, which was absurd anyway, but that was actually the high watermark of his reputation in Europe, and it's been downhill ever since.
And in terms of his attitude towards Britain, Freddie, in his piece this week, Tim Montgomery says Obama doesn't hate Britain, it's just that he cares less about us than any of his recent predecessors. Why is that? Why does he care less about Britain yet want to warn about the importance of the special relationship and the EU?
Well, I think it's a good point that Tim makes that he doesn't really hate Britain, because I think a lot of very sort of thin-skinned Brits got very upset about the removing of Churchill's bust and things like that. But I do think he doesn't really think about Britain. He doesn't only have sort of Churchillian romantic sense of the special relationship. And maybe that's a good thing. I don't think Janet will agree with me there. But I think that he's not somebody who thinks about Britain individually much. I think it is just a matter of bureaucratic convenience for him and for Washington that Europe should be one phone call.
And so that's why he supports Europe, is it just actually saves him a bit of time?
I think increasingly America sees Europe as a less important bloc, hence this pivot to Asia that we've seen under Obama.
I think, if you'll forgive me, it was the other way around. I think the pivot to Asia came first, and the irrelevance of Europe came second. But what difference does it make what he thinks? He's on his way out. He is now the lamest of ducks. He's finished. You know, what matters is what the next guy or the next woman thinks. And we know that even if it's Hillary Clinton, who is probably the closest figure to him, her view is quite, quite different about foreign policy. And I think it'll be dramatically different. Her views on foreign policy, on American exceptionalism, on intervention were almost identical to John McCain's. She was a great friend of his in the Senate. And I think we're going to see a very different foreign policy if she becomes president.
So would you expect to see a pivot back towards the West, a pivot back towards a proper special relationship with Britain?
Well, certainly a recognition of the fact that what Obama's, the vacuum that Obama has left in foreign policy, has made way for the most world-crushing domination by Putin. And I'm sure that that's something that she would appreciate. And I think it'll be very interesting to see, because she's almost certainly going to be the next president. It'll be very interesting to see how she views the deal with Iran, for example, how she sees the relationship with Syria. They've now given virtually a blank sheet to Putin to write his will on that region of the world. And they've made a quiet deal, clearly, about keeping the Assad regime alive, because that suits everybody's purposes. What's going to happen to that when he ceases to be president?
And Freddie, Obama has been very critical of British foreign policy and particularly its intervention in Libya. Obama doesn't seem quite so self-critical about his own approach towards particularly the Middle East.
No, well, I think the very good Atlantic piece about Obama's foreign policy, in which he said some quite shockingly critical things of Cameron, and particularly over Libya, the thing that really upset people was he touched on a truth, which is that Cameron really didn't think through Libya at all, and sort of really managed to cajole Obama, and with Sarkozy managed to cajole Obama into conducting an intervention that wasn't thought through at all, and nearly did it with Syria too.
Leading from behind, you remember that's what Obama said when he got caught out on that situation in Libya. It was inconceivable that France and Britain together could have done what needed to be done after the Libya intervention. They needed the American presence to sustain what had to be done, which was nation building effectively. Without America's leadership, they could do nothing. And they were hoping to chivy and chide Obama into providing that leadership, and he funked it. And he funked Syria, and then has now turned around and blamed Cameron.
Quite, but I mean, look what happened when you had America leading from the front. You know, you had Iraq, Afghanistan, a catalogue of disasters.
Absolutely. But what we've now learned is that you can do quite as much damage in the world, maybe even more damage, by not intervening as by intervening. America has to play a role. You know, you can't just decide that you're not going to be the world's protector or policeman or security. They are the one remaining superpower. And you have to make good use of that judgment. Arguably, Bush didn't make good use of it, but Obama has decided not to make any use of it, just to withdraw from the world.
And it's a strange tension, Freddie, isn't it, between this lack of self-confidence, apparently, on the world stage that we see from Obama and the overwhelming self-belief that Tim Montgomery criticises in Obama personally in his piece.
Well, I think that because he's been revered as a human being rather than revered for his policies. So he has that star factor, that celebrity star factor. And I can be as rude about him as I like. The fact is, a lot of Brits do think he's pretty cool still, even if he's actually a bit of a joke.
Yeah, it's sad to say that his real legacy will be in what he was, not what he did. And what he was the first black president, which is quite something. You know, it's very important. But the irony is that he didn't have the American black experience. He's not descended from slaves. His wife is. And he reinvented himself as this Chicago activist, you know, community organizer, as it's called. But he was raised by a white mother and a white grandmother, had an African father he never knew, and then an Indonesian stepfather. He has not had the classically black experience, and terribly sadly, relations between the races have actually deteriorated. The killings of unarmed black youths by policemen has been shocking in the last few years. It has not been helped by Obama's presidency.
You're both very clear that you think Obama's presidency has largely been a joke, but if I could end this discussion on a positive note, Freddie and then Janet, what has he done that you really admire?
I'm going to really annoy you, Janet. I think the Iran deal was actually quite a good diplomatic move. I think that the West's treatment of Iran has been wildly inconsistent, and we've managed to make a dreadful enemy in an important part of the world. And I think that for Obama to try and change that dynamic in the Middle East was quite a brave thing to do in the face of tremendous political resistance.
Well, it's consistent, all right. It's consistent with what Vladimir Putin would want. Iran. The difficulty is that Iran is Russia's proxy in that region, as an Assad. And we've now decided to let Assad get off free.
Why is it Russia's proxy? Because of decades of American hostility?
Possibly.
Yeah. Next, is Cameron heading for a hollow victory in the EU referendum? The Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth, says that whilst a vote for Brexit would be disastrous for the Prime Minister, even victory will come at a heavy price. He says in the magazine this week that the Tory leadership has long hoped the party could be put back together after June's vote. But is that prospect now looking less likely than ever? And in winning the referendum, could Cameron end up losing the party? I'm joined now by James Forsyth and Spectator editor Fraser Nelson. James, it's now widely accepted that Cameron has got the balance a little bit wrong in the EU referendum campaign when it comes to reuniting his party after the vote. Is it now too late for him to repair relations with backbenchers?
I think in the last few days, the blue-on-blue attacks have become a lot more violent, and they've touched on people's fitness to govern, which I think is what is hard to forget. You know, George Osborne has accused those people who want to leave of being economically illiterate. That means he thinks that there are six people sitting around the cabinet table, five now, me and Duncan Smith having resigned, who do not understand economics. Boris Johnson has accused by name David Cameron, George Osborne and Theresa May of having misled voters on immigration, saying that, you know, the Tories were going to get this change, that you could only come to Britain from the EU if you had a job, and then failing to do so. I think as these attacks become more and more personal, I think it becomes harder to see how you can bind up the wounds afterwards. I think the other problem for Cameron is that the centre-right in Britain is becoming steadily less enthusiastic about the EU. In 1975, the Tories were the enthusiastic pro-EU party. They are not that now. And it is now the left in Britain that are the kind of pro-Europeans. And I think that suggests that in the long term, the Tory party is going to end up being an out party.
Fraser Nelson, aren't the Eurosceptics just getting rather worked up about something that was inevitable, which was the Prime Minister doing everything he can to win a referendum?
Yeah, and I don't understand why they do get so angry. They know what elections are like. You throw the kitchen sink at it, especially if you think your survival is on the line, as David Cameron is now convinced his survival is on the line. But, of course, it's very difficult for couples to have a sort of trial separation and then get back together. I mean, the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives tried it during the AV campaign. Okay, let's disunite, let's fight each other, and let's see if we can get back. It was always a little bit difficult after that, and it's always been an open question as to how far the Tories can separate, fight each other, and then come back. I like to think that right now it might seem to them and to everybody else like it will never be united, but looking across the dispatch box at a Jeremy Corbyn who is getting a little bit better in Parliament and whose chances of winning the next election are not as good as David Cameron's, but still not negligible, certainly not if the bookmakers are concerned, but that ought to unite the Tories. It's very difficult to tell, though, just how many of these of the fights and the name calling will be forgotten when they're called upon to unite behind their real common enemy.
James, are you expecting a change in the tone of the campaign over the next few weeks as David Cameron comes to terms with the fact that he's really upset his MPs?
No, I mean that Cameron's view is
that he doesn't care, basically.
No, I don't think that's right either. Basically, what it is Cameron knows that if he were to lose the referendum, all of his party management problems would look like small beer because he would be out on his ear as Prime Minister. So I think his and Osborne's view is you do everything you can to try and win, and then when you've won, you try and do, you know, in victory magnanimity, as Winston Churchill said. I think the problem is this, is William Hague, who is kind of writing his column more regularly, partly at Number 10's urging for The Telegraph, wrote recently that, you know, every good Conservative should feel conflicted on the EU. And the problem is that the nature of campaigning means that Cameron and Osborne don't sound conflicted at all. They sound like they think it is an unambiguously good thing. And I think they have another problem, which is there's a lot of anger amongst Tory MPs that at the confirmation of something that we always knew, but they never admitted, but they were never going to campaign for leave. You know, you listen to what Cameron Osborne is saying now, it is quite clear that even if the European Union turned around and said, terribly sorry, we're going to have to give you not very much at all, which is almost what happened, they were still going to back staying in. I think that's part of the anger is, well, why on earth are we having this referendum if you think that there is absolutely no circumstance in which it would make sense to leave?
I think the anger has been heightened by the failure of renegotiation. They might have said earlier, yes, we didn't want to stay until we got this great deal, now we've changed our minds. Now, because the renegotiation was an utter failure, you hardly ever hear it referred to by the In campaign, then David Cameron and George Osborne have to say, actually, we've always believed that leaving the EU would be a disaster, which is at odds with what they've been telling their party and a lot of other people for the last 3 or 4 years. So it makes them look as if they've been dishonest. But of course, all arguments drive people to extremes. I mean, Boris Johnson wrote hundreds of columns and never revealed that he wanted to leave the EU. Now that he's, after wrestling with this decision, he's now emphatically in favour of it and thinks it's absolutely the right thing to do. Whereas James says, it ought to be a confliction. For the leading article in the magazine this week, we've complained about the fact that both sides are drawing caricatures, that neither side is accepting the reality or the complexity of this decision. Now, I personally think it'd be far more persuasive if somebody were to say, look, the EU is a real nuisance, it's a real headache, but what we stand to gain diplomatically by standing as one continent is worth it. In other words, accepting that the bad is the price that you pay for the good. But instead of that, both sides are giving binary and, to my mind, rather unconvincing arguments.
And do the interventions of this week from the Remain side actually work, James? We've got Barack Obama later this week visiting. We've had the five former US Treasury secretaries giving their views in a letter about the special relationship. Is that actually helpful to In?
I think the one that works is, whatever you might dispute the methodology, that Treasury number of £4,300 worse off per household. I think that will get traction because...
Because it scares people.
Yeah, because it scares people. And also because 4,300, one of the things that makes it powerful as a number is it's a credible, realistic number. If they said that families... No, I don't mean it's right or worked out correctly. But families wouldn't believe you if you said it was going to cost you £40,000 a household. People would think, oh, that can't be true. But it's just the right size of money for
so
people
sure.
to understand.
It is a quarter of your average person's disposable income. A quarter. That is a staggering amount of money.
By 2030, isn't it? I mean, it's...
I know, but the trick, the deceit is to try to think that is right now. I mean, if you were to use honest maths, which he failed to do, the figure would be closer to about £1,200-£1,300 by 2030 again. Again, this is income forfeited rather than a decrease. But I actually do think that the 4,000 figure is so large as to be incredible. Okay.
So I think there's that. I think the Obama stuff, I think it has mildly beneficial effect in that it is. But for that small number of voters who think that there's some choice between the special relationship and the EU, you're saying, don't worry about it. There isn't a choice. But I have huge respect for George Shultz and think he's one of the more remarkable public servants of our time. But I really don't think that many people are going to turn around and say, oh, George Shultz thinks we should stay in the EU, so therefore I do.
But it adds to the overall theme, which is what the government used in 1975, saying, listen to our allies. You might not be able to remember them by name, but you'll have the impression that over the last few weeks, everybody, Australia, America, any major head of state, they've all said, stay in.
I think one of the most fascinating things is the picture of Cameron with Neil Kinnock and Paddy Ashdown on the phones calling voters, because both campaigns called me up immediately after that was released saying this is a really powerful, important image. They both thought it was hugely helpful to their cause. The In campaign, because they thought it showed people working across party lines. It was a reminder to the voters that, you know, all the political parties, leaderships think that you should stay in the EU. And to the Out camp, because they thought it showed that, you know, this was the establishment lining up, you know, it's all a stitch up. And that it would repel voters, that, you know, when they look at Neil Kinnock, Ashdown and Cameron all getting together like that. Which one of those is right, I think, is going to determine the referendum.
And finally, this Saturday marks 400 years since Shakespeare died. But just how did the bard actually kick the bucket? Lloyd Evans considers the evidence in one of the great unsolved literary mysteries in this week's magazine. Some say Shakespeare might have drunk himself to death, others that he died of the pox. But is the truth just that no one really knows? Well, Shakespeare scholar Dr. Daniel Swift joins Lloyd to discuss this now. So, Daniel, are there any clues in any of his final plays that Shakespeare was sick?
I think it's a really interesting way of looking at the plays, which is exactly what Lloyd does in his piece, which is to figure out what's going on in the man's life from the plays. I'd say, curiously, what's happening, not only in the late plays, but throughout them, is a recurring concern with death itself and the absurdity of death sometimes, and also the way in which death can provoke a kind of storytelling.
Did he seem frightened of death in those plays?
I think so, yes. I think it's terrifying precisely because even in a deeply religious age, it's an entirely unknown question.
And Lloyd, you suggest in your piece that the bard may have drunk himself to death. Is that true, do you think?
Well, that comes from a diary entry created by the vicar of Holy Trinity Church. And in 1661, nearly half a century after Shakespeare died, he suggested that Shakespeare had a merry meeting with Ben Jonson and another local poet, and that they got drunk together, and then Shakespeare had contracted a fever and died. But it seemed a little bit too neat a rumour, and of course the story being, you know, 50 years later, it's odd that the details are so sort of perfectly aligned. So I think it might be just an invention.
Was Shakespeare a heavy drinker?
Not as far as we know, and this is the really interesting thing about that as a last story. The few records we have of Shakespeare paint a picture of quite a moderate man, and not only quite a moderate man, financially minded, kind of careful businessman. And what I think of was, in the light of that story about him being a drinker, is the statue that's in the church in Stratford where he's buried is of a kind of portly, responsible, sort of businessman-like figure. So I love the idea of these two very different images of Shakespeare in death. The one is the heavy drinking poet surrounded by poets, and the other is the slightly less attractive, perhaps, figure, who is this portly, sturdy businessman.
And had he made arrangements for his death, or was he, like many artists, completely disorganised?
Well, he had left a will, which I think he signed in March, just before he died, and the shaky hand is supposed to be evidence. His health was already slipping away. Although, I mean, I'm not sure that he wasn't necessarily a heavy drinker, because there's so much drink in the plays. I mean, you've got Falstaff, and you've got Sir Toby Belch and Andrew Agee-Cheek.
But he's always disapproving, isn't he, of those people?
He puts his disapproval in the mouth of Malvolio, and so he's sort of taking both sides of the argument, as he always does. But I mean, Macbeth is often played as a drunk, and Hamlet, of course, disapproves of drinking. But Shakespeare's father was an ale taster. That was one of his official functions, was to test beer. So I think, you know, there's some evidence that he would at least, you know, not have been a stranger.
We also, of course, have, just to jump in there, we have the magic love potion in Midsummer Night's Dream, which causes you to fall immediately in love with the first person that you see when you wake up, which has to be some kind of joke about drinking too much.
And in Othello as well.
Absolutely.
With
of what
Cassio,
alcohol
yes.
does to you.
And of course, there's this very peculiar intoxicant in Romeo and Juliet as well, which seems to knock you out for 24 hours. So I think, you know, he was quite interested in these mind-altering things.
And what can we glean from his plays about what he thought about what happened after death?
I think what he thought happened after death was, and this is an insight that's both a kind of tragic insight, it's about classical tragedy, but also with Christianity, which is that we learn a lesson about the person in some peculiar way. It's not a theological thing. I don't think Shakespeare thinks much about heaven versus hell or purgatory, but he's very conscious of things like fame and afterlife and reputation. That's how very often the tragic heroes end, is by handing on these instructions to other people to tell their story, to report my cause aright. It's what Hamlet asks for. So he's concerned with, again, it's not quite answering your question, but it's sort of afterlife rather than eternity.
Yes, I mean, he doesn't really seem to subscribe very much to the Christian notion of heaven and hell that much. He doesn't mention Jesus or Christ, I think, at all, anywhere in the plays. And the word eternal always has a very malign connotation for him. So I think he was very much obviously aware of death throughout his life, probably afraid of it. But he's also very keen on generation and having children and you know, creating a legacy through that. Rather than, he's not a particularly Christian writer in many ways.
I think that's absolutely right. And the sonnets are the great collection of poems which are about this question of achieving eternity, both through having children and also through writing things like eternal poetry.
And is it not part of Shakespeare's appeal that he is an enigma? Would it not spoil the fun a little bit, Lloyd, if we actually did know what had happened to him?
Yes, we know a lot more now than we did when I was a kid. It was he was born on this day and died on the same day, 52 years later. But a lot more evidence has come to light since then, and I expect more will. And yes, the more you find out about somebody's actual life, then in a way that harms the iconic image that you have. So in a way, it's better that we know less about him than we might do.
Do you agree, Daniel?
I do agree, and I think that oddly some of the things we know about him seem to be a curiously bad fit with our expectation again of a great kind of romantic or poetic figure. So the writer, the poet who creates Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet doesn't fit quite right with this figure who also made vast amounts of money from collecting tithes in Stratford, was very concerned with the, you know, trading in grain and so on. So those records, those things we do know, there are a few of them and they're almost of the wrong type.
And I think if we do find out stuff about him, it's likely to be, you know, pretty disreputable. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to find that he was a deserter if he ever joined an army. He certainly spent an awful lot of time in brothels. And in fact, it's almost certain that he wrote most of his early work in brothels at night, because the actor's life was very busy during the day. They were rehearsing in the morning, acting in the afternoon, and so the only time he would have had to write the plays would have been in the evening, when as a young writer he wouldn't have been able to afford candles. So he probably went to brothels and pubs, basically lap dancing clubs, and wrote those great early plays, which I think is always interesting, because people say, well, I need to go to a special quiet place in order to write, but you know, Romeo and Juliet was probably written in a busy brothel.
And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store. And a reminder that podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22. Thanks for listening. I'm Isabel Hardman.